Hello, and welcome to our podcast episode. This is an assignment that is a part of the course Sustainable Organizing in Times of Crisis at Hanken School of Economics. Our group consists of myself, Camilla Lehtinen, Rebecca Laaksonen, Hemant Vodekar, Simon Enqvist, and Daniel Schönberg. In today's episode, we will discuss topics about agroecology with Joshua Finch from Finch Agroecology. Enjoy! Briefly go with an introduction here firstly. So hello and welcome to our podcast assignment. So we are doing this podcast as a part of our course Sustainable Organizing in Times of Crisis at Hanken School of Economics. And my name is Camilla, and with me today I have...
Hi, I'm Rebecca. I'm also here. And who else I can quickly present so we save some time. I have Daniel with me, Simon and Hermant, and of course, super well welcome to you, Joshua, as well.
I'm on mute. Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, Camilla, it's fine by you if I start with the first questions.
Yes, you can go ahead.
Yes. So we have divided this into a more listener-friendly format. So we start with getting to know you, Joshua, so our listeners get to know you and also a bit about agroecology in the concept itself. Then we delve more into your business. I mean, we are students at the Hanken School of Economics, so we are interested in the business side as well. And then, of course, agroecologists, maybe something someone or anyone here wants to adapt. So we have the expert Joshua here with us and want maybe to get some tips and tricks from you as well. But yeah, to the introductory part, please, Joshua, tell a bit about yourself. We want to get to know you better.
All right, well, thank you for that. Well, my name is Joshua, and I am not Finnish. I'm an American. I was born in Southwest Florida in the United States.
Yeah.
So I'm from a borderline true tropical climate. But I moved to Finland 10 years ago. My wife is Finnish. And I wanted to experience something other than the United States. So we moved here, and pretty much, you know, actually even before I landed, I was already getting in touch with people who were working with urban farming because we moved to Helsinki. So urban farming made sense. Mm-hmm. I'm actually not all that, oddly enough, I'm not very interested in urban farming. Like, it's not really for me personally. But I got in touch with people, and, you know, 2016, I received funding, well, it's Starttiraha, the startup support, which is, I always laugh and call it unemployment for, it's because it's the same, it's like the same amount of money, but now you've moved categories, but it's super useful. It really was nice to have. I don't think I would have started the same way without it. And so I've been working with agroecology, with permaculture for a long time since I became interested in the ideas, which was when I was a university student studying history, University of South Florida. And, you know, Americans, we have a different university system, to say the least, not just because we have to pay a lot more for it, but it's a very different idea. And it's highly encouraged at most universities to get involved with nonprofits or with student organizations, which operate, you know, more or less like nonprofits. And so I was interested in the environment because I was in Florida. And, you know, if you know anything about Florida, if you don't know anything about Florida, most of it sits only a couple meters above sea level. And so when you learn about climate change and you look at the maps, you're like, wait, where did Florida go? And then you realize, wait, what are we doing about this? So after about a year being introduced to these ideas, I got frustrated that we were mostly complaining about other people and what other people were doing. And that's how the agricultural side got interesting for me, was like, well, this is something we can do. And I could go on a lot longer than that, but I'm not going to. We'll go to the next. We can go to another question or follow-up.
Yeah, that was super good introduction to you. And I think it's important for our listeners also to hear that you have experience from many, many different kind of ecological environments. So you have seen some stuff, but just to get into the agroecology as a concept itself, if you want to define it for you, what it means for you in just like one sentence, two sentences, so we can start getting into that topic, and then of course Finch agroecology after that.
Well, I like how that you framed it as how I see it, because it is seen very differently by many other people.
Mm-hmm.
If I boil it down to one sentence, it's the understanding that we live within a biosphere, and agriculture came after the biosphere, and therefore we should take the lessons from, I think, flowering plants or something like 100 million years of evolution, just flowering plants. So perhaps we should try to orient our agricultural systems towards this super resilient 100 plus million year old evolution, and then see what we can do as humans to support that system, rather than try to like rebuild something completely different that's not even based on this. So agroecology for me is the incorporating the lessons of ecology into agriculture, on the understanding that we live within it.
Yeah. Yeah. Is this also kind of how you started to get into your business with Finch Agroecology, or how did that idea pop up? You told something about the Starttiraha.
Well, it didn't start as Finch Agroecology. It started as Lil Claw Permaculture, and that's because I'm extremely uncreative when it comes to names. I'm not very good at it, and so I had asked if I could start a small farm at a place called Lil Claw, and mm-hmm. I was interested in using permaculture design to do that. So I put those two things together, and I knew I wouldn't really ever get into marketing too much. Okay, that's not something that maybe economic students want to hear, but I'm more of a word of mouth kind of person. So, you know, I didn't think too much about the name. And the idea there was to take a place that had a lot of potential. So it was a 2.5 hectare lot in the city that has over 500 years of recorded farming history. The people who lived there, there were more than one family, but they owned much of that part of Espoo, and, you know, sold all of that off over time. And then they moved in the 70s, I think it was, when the highway got built there, and they decided, look, we have enough money, we don't have to live next to a loud highway. That's probably not the way they would say it, but that's how I would imagine, because it's loud. It's really loud there. And so it's been forgotten, but it has a lot of potential. And it has a lot of potential as well because there are more than one youth theater that operate from that space. So we had the potential to implement bifurcated design, with one half focusing on small scale commercial agroecology, and the other on large scale forest gardens, and incorporating children, outdoor theater, and teaching about like domestic scale ideas. And if you do that right in the middle of the biggest city in Finland, you know, if someone's interested, then there's very little barrier for them to come visit, because it's not a 2-hour bus ride. You know, it's okay, maybe it's an hour bus ride if they live in East Helsinki, but it's definitely the barrier to seeing it and experiencing it would be very small. The last thing I'd say is that it was going really well, and then it wasn't. Corona came, and so as soon as I was ready to start teaching, because I didn't want to teach or share like anything until I had something to show people, because I really don't like it when people learn something and then 2 days later they start trying to sell it. I can smell that from a mile away. And it happens way too often with sustainability and stuff like this. But then Corona came and we weren't allowed to see people. And then after almost 5 years in, Espoo decided that they didn't want me there anymore. They never said why specifically. I won't get into anything more than that, but that's the way it was. And we all just sort of nodded our heads and went in another direction. So Finch Agroecology then was born a couple of years ago when I realized no one knew where Lil Claw was. fine. And then permaculture, I like permaculture design, but the first, if you Google permaculture or you put permaculture into YouTube, a lot of the first hits that come up are not things that I identify with. Mm-hmm. And there are things that my target audience don't identify with. So I decided it would probably be best to, and also I didn't want to differentiate what I was doing based on something that I want to be commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want it to be commonplace, why would I use it to be like, hey, I'm doing permaculture. It's like everybody should do permaculture. Then it would mean nothing if everyone's doing it. So Finch Agroecology was a way to step back and focus it on what it was really happening. And that was mm-hmm. me doing weird and wacky stuff and doing it under this bigger framework of focusing on the ecology.
Yeah. Thank you. I think this gave a really good introduction and also understanding of what we're going to talk more about next. So Daniel, I will hand it over to you.
Yes, so we were a bit interested why you moved from Florida to Finland, but you gave a short introduction on that. But did you move here because of your wife, or was it more like you wanted to experience another country, and why Finland?
My wife would have to say it's my wife, for sure. Yeah, that made it so much easier, of course, because no one asks any questions as soon as you're here for family ties, that's for mm-hmm. sure. But, you know, truth be told, I was interested in moving to Sweden at first. And that's never going to happen now that I live in Finland. But I did really want to live someplace where even almost all people agree that if you get sick, you can go to the doctor and you should be able to see a doctor and get treatment and you shouldn't go broke. Or if you decide to have children, that you don't have to have $50,000 for an ambulance. You know, that's yeah. what it takes to get to the hospital. And so I got tired personally, and we were speaking here from my, you know, personal business. So that's mm-hmm. nice. I can say what I want to say is that, you know, I got tired of being called a communist. Even though in Finland, I'm center right in Finland. Like, yeah. you know, to go from being communist to being conservative just by changing to geography is wild. And, you know, that's it. You know, Finland is a great place to be if this is the kind of system you want to live in.
Yeah, sounds good. And there is some differences with Florida and Finland. Mm-hmm. And one of those is the weather. So how have you like the four seasons here, and what do you do during winter times when you can maybe do that much in the garden?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the hardest thing about being here is not the cold, for sure. I mean, of course I mind it to a degree when it's June or mid, you know, we're supposed to be celebrating midsummer and I'm wearing a jacket. My wife, one of the first things we did is I moved the week before midsummer was to buy a summer jacket. And I said, this is an oxymoron. There's no such thing as a summer jacket. But truth be told is the darkness. That's the hardest part for me is how dark it is. So where I'm from, we have sometimes more sunlight on Christmas than this part of Finland gets in the whole month of December. Right. So like one of the shortest days. So that's the hardest. That's why my face is totally lit up right now, is because I have one of these giant lamps. And in the last couple of years, I've had that. And that has taken away the seasonal affect disorder, like completely for me. So, you know, that's the hardest part of adjustment is the darkness and how it affects the body, because there's no way of getting around that. And then, you know, what do I do during the winter? Well, fortunately, I do live in southern Finland. So sometimes the snow melts in mid-April. And by the time the snow melts, if you've got healthy soil, then you can start doing what's the right word? It's been a few years since I've done this, but you can go out on a limb and you can plant early. And if it works, then you're like, you know, yeah, but it's not like your main thing. So in order to do that, you have to start in March. So really, you know, I start from March until, you know, almost until Christmas, I can farm in southern Finland. So there's not that much downtime. And then the rest of it is business analysis. And when you're not trained, I'm a historian, with quotes. I don't know spreadsheets or anything like this. So I had to learn all that myself. I don't have any of that business acumen. I have no business training. Everything that I know is from what I've read and what I've had to do. So it takes me a lot longer than probably any of you to analyze my business. But I try to do it really thoroughly. So we'll look at every single week that we sold something, and we will break that down by who was buying it and what exactly did they buy, and what did I plan to sell that week. And so you get a really annoying looking spreadsheet, but at the end of the day, that allows you then to really dial in the seed orders and exactly the way that I wanted the business to look the next year. So I didn't really take much time off because I was constantly reiterating my system every winter. So it's design and writing. I do a lot of writing. Maybe I don't publish everything that I write, but I do a lot of writing. So, you know, the winter for me is spent that way. And that's how I planned it too, was that it would be work, incorporate feedback, and then also I was hoping to do more teaching in the winter, you know, of the theory and fundamentals. But like I said, Corona came around and nobody wanted to see me anymore. So
True. Okay, well, interesting to hear also about the business side. And I was wondering, have you seen any trends sold products during, or some interesting trends of sold products during your 5 years at Little Club?
I certainly did. Yeah, I certainly saw some trends. So in small scale market gardening, where you're growing mostly annual plants and you try to grow almost as much as you can, as fast as you can, in like a 3 month growing season, there are certain crops that as you go onto YouTube, University of YouTube, and you also see in market garden courses that float to the top based on your scale. And at my scale, being at the small end of that, a lot of things that were promoted were these fast growing vegetables, radishes, but also a lot of salad crops that you grow, not microgreens or sprouts. You can buy these at the store. They just come out of the seed, but you let them grow a little bit bigger to the baby. They call it the baby phase, which is very funny when you harvest them, because then you take this blade that cuts with it's an electric blade, and then you're slicing these baby plants off and like babies. And I try to laugh at what we call things a lot.
Yeah.
But what I found was with that, was trying to bring that process into play with my personal goals for sustainability. And if you go to the supermarket and you look for baby greens, think rucola, right? Or any of these, what are they sold in? They're sold in little plastic containers that are single-use containers. It's a convenience food is what it is. It's a convenience food, and it's got a high price point, but then you're generating quite a bit of plastic. So what I tried to do to get around that was to try to sell that by volume. So I always ask my customers to bring containers, and then we would use a scoop and sell, like a liter, Of course, I'd have an idea of how much it weighed or whatever, and they would know and everything. But the trend was that as soon as you did that, as soon as you asked people to bring a reusable container, your sales went way down. Because that's not what people were after. Even if they espouse the sustainable ethic, as soon as they're asked to do one extra step, which is to slow down and let me put the food in your bucket, that's too much. Even if it means that they would even save money, because very often my prices were a lot less for those things. So that was a trend. Another thing is that, people have a really strong sense of seasonality here, but not based on what is in season. It's based on what they're used to seeing in season. So I was able to bring to market a lot of vegetables and I was almost exclusively outdoors. I had a very small greenhouse for starting baby plants. So it's not like I had, 5 hectares under glass being heated or something so I could do tomatoes year round. It was outside, but I could still bring things to the market a lot sooner, and people just want to buy them. I didn't know that you could have, this in this month. And I'm like, yeah, well, here it is. And it's good. But, but that's that's a winter vegetable. Okay. Now it's going to be a compost vegetable. Nobody buys it. But, that was something, too, that I found was interesting, is that people were kind of in shock, really, that they could get that kind of diversity that soon. And so that's something that has started to change, I think, in the last few years. But it's hard to say. I only have my own experience. I can also tell you that customers, you can give people too much. And so the trend really needs to be, you know, matching their expectations with what you bring to them, and really making sure you only give them what they can use. Because even if they can preserve it, they're not going to. So I guess the overall thing that I'm kind of pushing at here is that just because customers say one thing doesn't mean they actually do it or want it. Yeah. And you have to be adaptable to find that out, and also be willing to let go of some things. Like, there's a lot of vegetables that I love to grow and I like to eat, but other people don't like to eat it. And so you just don't grow it anymore.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And actually, the next question would have been that what would you have wished to known before starting Lilleklubben? And I think you told about many of those things maybe already, but how would you summarize for yourself 5 years or 10 years earlier? What would you tell to you?
It's interesting because the answer to that question, to give a good answer, we'd have to have a hypothetical that would be that I would have been allowed to stay at Lil Club as long as I wanted, because anything that I would have learned that could have made the business grow, and there were a lot of things that I did learn that helped me produce more and better, in many ways that would have actually put me in a worse position than I am now, because it would have meant that I would have a larger financial, or I'd have a larger need personally for that income, and then to have that taken away from me without ceremony would have been a harder place to fall from necessarily, or to jump to something new. So yeah, if we could pretend that I could be there as long as I intended, then the importance of cold storage on the site. So that was something I tried to have from the beginning, but it was always really slow. But as soon as I had the proper refrigerator, and this is really specific to farming, you know, mm-hmm. like, who cares? But you know, having the refrigerator changed everything.
Yeah.
And it's really funny to think about how much it changes things. But to go from needing to harvest between, you know, 24 hours, you couldn't really harvest much more than 24 hours before. So you'd be working crazy hard to deal with all the orders and to get everything set up and to have it be quality when you're there, not just be like collapsing under your sweat and compost mud. Like, oh, here's your vegetables, but like to have it presentable. The cold storage helps so much with that. And then something else that is maybe more broadly applicable would be either learn something about contract law or find someone who's willing to help you and stick it to people who don't uphold their end of the deal. I really wish I had learned that, because I have been in a lot of situations over the last few years where people say one thing, they even write one thing, and then they'll do another, and it hasn't worked out in my favor. So I would definitely be looking into, you know, pursuing my interests more strongly.
Yeah.
I think the thing is that in this space about sustainability, we want to have this impression that the people we're working with are also working from an ethical point of view. But it's just, unfortunately, better safe than sorry. Business has to be business at some point.
Yes, that's true. Rebecca, you had some question maybe.
Yeah, I was thinking when you were saying about different deals and, you know, so I wanted to ask, how do you think that the Finnish market, or let's say the market in Espoo, responded to your business with Lilleklubben, and or the sustainability idea overall? How do you think the response was?
It was overwhelmingly positive, honestly. You would think if I say this that I would have turned out to have a lot more money in my pocket than I do, but it costs a lot of money to start a farm from scratch, especially when you don't have anything to begin with. I never had a problem selling my products. My problem was always I couldn't grow enough where I was because the space was too small. That's something that happened to me, is the place was too small to do things in a way that I felt were the right way to go about them. So I, you know, this third year, when we really made a push to see how far we could, how much we could get from this place. So that was 2019. I had set a goal. Now you have to remember that the farm is tiny. All right.
Yeah.
It's really small. It's very small. But I set a goal to raise 10,000 euros in pre-sales from this community support agriculture program. And well before the cutoff date, I had to close the form because it was already full. And I was afraid, and we didn't have the cold storage yet. I was pushing really hard to get that and I didn't have it. And so I was afraid. And so I said, okay, like no more. People want more, but I'm not going to be contractually, you know, obligated to this. So people, I never had that problem. And I can't speak for any other farmer. There are lots of other farmers in Finland. There are a lot of other people growing vegetables.
Yeah.
But one of the ways that I tried to market without marketing was to say what I was doing as clearly as I could, which I'm not very good at because I talk too much and I'm very like, I don't do summaries. So that can be a turnoff for people, but I tried really hard to get what I wanted to say as small as possible, have it only be about my farm, because with marketing, whatever you say also is a reflection of the other people in the market space. So if you make a claim about your farm doing this, that, or the other, then people will start to think, well, what is he saying about the other farmers? So I was trying really hard not to disparage other farmers because there's so many other farmers and it's also a small knit community. And so there's no point. If I want people to look at what I'm doing and model their farm after it, than to, you know, say that I'm number one, I've got the most sustainable products or anything like this. So I talked about what I was doing and then my prices. So some of my prices were more than at the supermarket, but almost always when people would say, well, how do you come up with your prices? I go to the grocery store and I look around and I write down how much they're selling per kilo. And then I look at it and I'm like, well, is my product better than this or is it worse?
Yeah.
Because I didn't also want to set it up that only people with lots of money could purchase food from my farm. So very often, if you join the community supported agriculture program, you might get 15 to 20% more food, more value than what you actually paid, or the nominal price. And then they got a discount. So they actually usually were getting like 30 to 40% more food than what they had bargained for. So that kept people coming back, was that they didn't have to think about the price so much because it somehow felt, good.
Yeah. But yeah, that sounds like the Finnish market is, or at least the market is ready for it. So I think this leads to your next question. Like you give me the question.
yes. And you also told that the deal club and area was maybe a bit too small, and now when that project is over, so what's your next project, and is it going to be bigger then, and or do you know yet?
Well, it's funny. So currently I'm working full time as a project manager for Novia University of Applied Sciences, and I don't have a farm. We have a project site and it's very different. So it takes what I found interesting from Loklob, which was not necessarily the vegetable production anymore, although there were a lot of things I still would love to have kept developing there. But really, like, when you start to think about how many vegetables you have to grow and sell to earn a living, it really makes you start to wonder about the priorities here, because, you know, have you ever stopped to consider what 50,000 euros worth of vegetables looks like? And that's in order to pay one, that would be to pay one person, you know, pension and insurance, and then to have them get a decent you know, income. So even if you sold 50,000 euros in vegetables, you still don't have enough money to pay to grow those vegetables in the first place. So, you know, we had actually run through this scenario a few times about how much space it would be to have a viable small farm. And I came to the conclusion that what I'd really need is about 5 hectares. And it would be designed so that the vegetables don't take up the whole 5, but you have a, you know, you have a system there, and then that should produce enough revenue to pay 3 people, not throughout the whole year, but one per, you know, we had the models, you know, go a few different directions, but it felt good at about 5 hectares, 100 families, food for 6 months out of the year. But that's still a lot, you know, it's a lot of work, and you'd have to find the land. And then you'd have to find somebody with the land who's willing to let that happen, because you'd probably lose your subsidies, because the EU hates this kind of farming. Nobody wants to think about it. It's too complicated for them. And they want to be able to check boxes about what you're doing. So you'd have to also find somebody who's willing to, you know, decrease their property value by withdrawing the farm from the system in all likelihood. So I'm not going in that direction. So my as a project manager, I'm doing something else, and I'm following my passion, and that was bioremediation with plants and fungi, and like using biology to restore soil fertility. So we have a field that was taken out of production. You can actually look at the aerial images from, you know, today, going back until 1944. Is the first aerial picture taken during the Second World War. And you can follow that farm's like modern history, and you can look and you can see where that field started to degrade. And then it was no longer producing anything of value. So we're going in there, and we are implementing on a small scale, about 8,000 square meters, a system that brings sort of like all the things into that field that you would need to do on a bigger scale. And then following the soil's development. It's really hard to sum up in one thing, because we didn't just change one variable in the system. Like, we're going from monocultures to polycultures. We're going from annual plants to perennials and annuals. We're going from only cash crop production to cash crop production, biodiversity production, so to speak. And multi-layered in space and in time systems. So like the whole thing is totally different, but it's also really exciting because it's the only project of its kind in Finland at the moment, which is weird. Usually I never try to say that, because I'm worried someone's gonna like come out of the woods and say like that they're actually doing it, and then I'm wrong. But we've talked with people who know, and it could be the only one doing this. And the idea there, which sets it apart from high labor, high intensity, is that it's been designed to use tractors and machines as much as possible. And then where we can't use tractors and machines, then as the project manager, it's my job to stop and write 2, 3, 4 other options that if a machine was available, what should the machine be doing?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that was the least clear answer I could give you on that. It's a different direction. It's Lil Nagels and Kirkonumi. We just got started, and it's weird. You know, it's really weird, because I get paid. Again, I'm not speaking from Novia's perspective at this point. You're just getting me. I get paid on the 15th of every month, and yeah. I didn't have to grow a vegetable and, you know, sell it. So it also in some ways feels a bit like I'm copping out. It feels like I'm not exactly selling out, but it does. I feel like I am losing credibility, even if we're recording the time in the field properly and making sure that the calculations for profitability are based on like what's actually taking place. It's still, there's no way to get around the fact that I'm much more comfortable now, at least for the next 8 months. Than I would be if I was farming. So we're taking risks that most farmers would not be allowed to take or wouldn't be willing to take, but that's a pilot project, right? I mean, why do a pilot project if you just do what everybody else is doing and don't try anything new. So
yeah, I think that's also a really important job that you're doing now, and to get more knowledge on the topic, that's really important for future agro farmers. So
we hope so. Yeah. At the very least, you know, at the very least, we're going to learn a lot of things that don't work. And like, that's going to be really valuable for people too, because what works only may not, what works in Kirkkonummi may not work somewhere else, you know, and even 20 miles away, because the people who work it are different and their context is different. But if something doesn't work, like absolutely doesn't work, those things usually scale. Usually those things kind of, you know, if it really doesn't work, then everyone knows and we can save people time and heartache.
Yeah, sounds great. And then Simon, you had some questions.
Yeah, okay. You're a goldmine of information and you've answered half of them already, but I will adapt them and ask them anyway. So while we're on the topic of your career and such, so could you please tell us what it's been like being like a teacher or a consultant in this agroecology and agriculture that you're in? So how's the business looking in Finland and overall for your line of work?
Oh, well, it's hard here to say the least. You know, the hardest part probably is that I don't come from a farming background in Finland. And the people who are still farming in Finland, it's just my impression, is that there's a high barrier to getting within their so-called circle of trust, right? They've seen a lot of things. They've been promised a lot of things. And, you know, I think the last thing they want is somebody from Florida coming and saying, like, this is the way. I mean, I've been told since I came here that, you know, you're not in Florida anymore. And so that's a big thing. And then also the language, right? So, you know, in Finland, especially younger people speak English quite well. But even if you try to avoid jargon, it still comes along with the territory. And so it's very easy to start talking way past people. And they're so polite that they don't tell you to stop. And so it's not until the end that they're like, I only understood about a half of what you were saying. Yeah. And so that can be a challenge. And I've also found that in Finnish, so I don't speak Swedish, there are some words that simply don't exist.
Like, do you speak, by the way, Finnish or at all?
My Finnish is okay. You know, my Finnish is okay. I understand quite a lot, but I also need faces. So I can't speak Finnish on the phone really at all. I have to have the human interaction. Otherwise, I just feel like I'm not making any sense. So I can speak normal things, but I'm not fluent. And of course, my bar for fluency is quite high because in English, at least, you know, I write in, you know, I'm used to like university level academic kind of writing. So you know, I compare my Finnish and it's way down. So those are two big mitigating factors for it having developed, right? And then and I also mentioned that I didn't want to promote what I was doing until I had something to show people. And by the time that happened, then Corona came. So it really just never took off. But I was able to, you know, get in touch with sort of the right people that this project opened up, right? So, you know, it wasn't a success. And then it was like, you know, suddenly that's all I was doing very little of it. And then that was all I was doing, you know, is the consulting in some ways. But I think that it's going to grow very fast because the sheer number of farmers around the world adopting these ideas is staggering. Like you know, you were getting 15-16% adoption rates on some of these techniques in, you know, Iowa or Illinois of all places, where that's the heart of industrial agriculture, as far as I'm concerned, like in, you know, at least in the US. And so people are changing rapidly. And when you have that many people, you know, failing, but also doing well, the practices suddenly gain a lot of credibility with farmers who, you know, they want to see a scientific study, perhaps, but what they really want to hear is how this helped another farmer. And so when you have, when you can go to any state, any province of Canada, when you can go to, you know, even you, you know, Ukraine is a huge agricultural country as well. And, you know, before the war, like, and even during the war, right, there are a lot of people who are putting these things into practice, gaining success. So farmers in Finland are seeing that, and they also want to, I wouldn't say get in on the action, but they also want to figure out what this is all about. So when they realize, the biggest thing about all of this is mindset, because you can't do any of this without changing the way you see the farm. And that's the agroecology for me. You can pick up the five or six principles, but if you don't put them to work in concert, they don't work very well. But once they start to work, you gain more financial independence. And with financial independence and stability, to some degree, it's still farming, comes operating space, headspace to think about new things. So it's one of those age-old things where, you know, to those who have, more will be given. And it's, if you don't have anything, that sounds awful. But if you follow these principles, you can start to have something and build on that success. And I think that will restore a lot of the independence that farmers want to have as well. So I think the future is really bright, but it's going to take a few more years before it becomes more commonplace, because really the farmer attitudes and the bureaucracy around farming in Finland, from my personal perspective, are, to use an overused term, extremely toxic. You look at like the common agricultural policy at a glance, you know, paperwork that all the countries have to put out. Go through and read some of those, and then read Finland's. And Finland's is like, you know, a defensive, it's awful here, but we do it anyway, kind of paper. And you read Denmark, which of course has a better climate than Finland in some degree, but you read some of the other ones, and like they don't read this way. And so the mindset and this constant negativity about being here and how there's no opportunity, unless farmers can break free of that and say that they're tired of hearing it, the same way that I got tired of hearing about how awful it was to be a human being when I was in the university. It was like everything about being human's terrible. We only destroy. We can't make anything better. It's probably better if none of us were here anyway. Like, how do you expect anybody to develop anything positive if that's the messaging, even if there's some truth in, you know, some kernels of truth? So I hope that kind of gets a bit to your answer, but it's got to be mindset. Yeah. We got to stop being afraid of being positive.
So for the everyday citizen, how's the interest there? Is there a genuine interest in practicing these things as well as just buying from the producers or farmers themselves? Is there an equal interest among?
Well, I don't. It's interesting. I could answer that from a few different perspectives. One thing that I have noticed is that there are, it seems like there are more younger people. Young can be a relative term, who are interested in becoming farmers. And a lot of them, when they do, they settle on some constellation of these patterns being put into practice. So maybe they're interested in, holistic plant grazing, and they don't want to grow a vegetable, but they would really like to maintain the landscape in a perennial system. Or maybe they do want to grow vegetables. And so there are a large number. For Finland anyway, it seems like there are a lot of these small scale farms popping up, and that's wonderful. I think that the consumer demand, Finland's a tough cookie. Like, I speak from the Helsinki region, and that automatically disqualifies me for a lot of people because I don't have the same struggles that somebody 3 hours away with no market has to deal with. But I think that there is demand for it. And when I mentioned that independence of farmers, I think Finns, if I can generalize in a positive way, do like this idea of Finland being able to produce for itself even if it's old school and it's anti-globalization or it's this, that, or the other, like they like to know that their community is viable. And these processes help communities become viable. But again, being in the Helsinki region, it's just big enough that the sample is large enough that we can find this niche. But I do think that overall, most of the eco-conscious people, this is again my opinion, they don't want to farm. They never want to farm. They'll never want to farm. And they also don't want to learn anything about farming. That might be odd to hear, but I think that a lot of people who, again, espouse certain ideas, they're not actually very interested in learning for themselves what's taking place on farms. So, you know, where are you going to find the biggest market for lab-grown meats? Helsinki. Where are you going to find the biggest markets for vegan vegetables? You know, it's going to be Helsinki. Now, if you want to be vegan, that's fine. I'm not saying that no one should be vegan. It's your own thing. But to go, you know, I've been told by the outspoken vegans that they won't buy my food because my food's not vegan. And I tell them that there's no possible way that I can grow this food with it being vegan, because I also care about the soil life, and that includes animals. I raise animals. Composting worms are animals, folks, you know, and I keep them in a concentrated animal feeding operation, you know, CAFO, and I feed them on a regular basis in order to harvest their products. And so, like, I can't call what I'm doing vegan. And so what I'm trying to get at is, like, there's a big dichotomy between what is possible and what people are being told is possible, you know, with agriculture. And that's something that farmers also are going to have to start to stand up and say something about what they're doing, because it's no secret that there are groups of people who want to legislate other people's daily lives. And it could come to a point where some of these practices aren't possible legally, not because they don't have a good basis in terms of what they actually do, but because of people's mindsets and what they want to allow and not allow. And I think that that's something that's kind of dangerous. I think it's extremely dangerous is to do that. And so I went down a rabbit hole on that one. Sorry about that. But maybe a certain somebody warned you about the tendency.
Yeah, no worries. I have one thing still on my list that I want to check off with you. So we've been talking about degrowth in class, like how not if you want to grow constantly, you might not be able to be that sustainable in the future. So how do you implement degrowth, or how do you handle degrowth in your line of work, and how do farmers commercially look at degrowth?
Well, I have to be honest and say that I don't think about degrowth, but I also don't really think in that, you know, as a term. So the way that I handle growth or degrowth, or how would you might say the use of resources maybe by my business, is that I kind of mentioned that with the use of the single-use plastics already. Like, that's already something that I had to think about. I conceive of the farm with agroecology, so as a, you know, ecological processes, agriculture, marrying those two things together. How do you do that? Well, one way to do that is to use holistic management, which is a decision-making framework. And in that decision-making framework, we have, you know, four ecosystem processes. So we have to think about how each action or non-action affects those parts of the ecosystem, and whether or not those impacts are moving you towards your goal, which generally is to have an ecosystem that, you know, is getting better over time. So our goal is already regeneration. So in some sense, I don't really like the word degrowth in my field, because I see growth from this ecological and biological capital, and I want, you know, as much growth as I can. Like, I want, you know, as much solar energy converted into biological capital. And I don't really like that phrase, but most people will know what I'm getting at when I say biological capital, living things and dead things, as possible. And but you can only you can kind of put that into overdrive, though, if you make certain decisions, like if you want to use certain fertilizers, right? Or if you want to use a certain amount of irrigation, or if you want to cover your whole farm in plastic or in glass. There are a lot of regenerative farms that grow only inside under plastic. And then they go to the farmer's market and then they sell to customers who don't want to buy tomatoes from Spain that aren't grown under plastic. You know, and so you get these weird, you get these really strange, how would you call them? With like incongruencies, there's a word for this, is mental incongruency that takes place, where it's okay to cover everything in plastic if it's local, but it's wrong to cover it in plastic if it's in Spain. And so it doesn't make any sense. So degrowth for me wouldn't be anything that I would be personally interested in, but I'm interested in the whole, as far as possible, the whole chain of production of all of the inputs that I use on the farm. And I want to try to localize that as much as possible, because I see the farm as a service to the ecosystem and the community, the people, as well as obviously the organisms, but people, and that it needs to be stable, even if those chains of production that allow it to occur where I am are no longer available. Yeah. So I don't want to be sustainable only if I get X, Y, or Z inputs. At the same time, you have to be economically minded, and you can't tackle all of those supply chain issues in year one, right? So I've also been accused, I get accused of all kinds of things, but I've had people get extremely angry with me because of the seeds that I used, you know, like I used hybrid seeds as well as heirloom seeds. And if you know anything about hybrid seeds, you know that they're not produced on the farm. Although there's a new rice variety that looks like you can get, you can start doing hybrids on the farm, which is kind of interesting. But I wanted to see what the difference was. You know, I've heard the activist perspective, but now I'm a farmer as well as an activist in some degree. So why can't I do both? So sometimes people want it all at once. So degrowth, right, wouldn't mean jumping off the cliff, more than likely, I'm sure, right? So we also have to take that kind of curve, you know, into account.
Yeah.
So
degrowth.
Yeah.
It's not always bad.
No.
Not for everyone.
And, you know, it's a real, you know, what's the overall framework that we're even conceptualizing economic activity yet, right? And, you know, for me, growth is a problem if, you know, economic growth is a problem if economic growth is divorced from, we live within a biosphere and the biosphere has certain processes that need to work in certain ways so that we can continue to exist. You know, so if the growth is working to pull that apart, then it's a problem. But if the growth is looking to support those things, then it's a benefit. So we have to even get down to all the way down to what it is that you find valuable as a human being. What is value? Where does that come from? Is it intrinsic in nature, or is value, you know, completely a cultural construction? And I think that it's a bit of both. But I, you know, I think that we've got some major issues if we don't, get more people talking about these, if we don't get more people talking about this, because again, decisions are going to be made. I alluded to that in my rabbit hole. Decisions are going to start, are already starting to be made at levels at which normal citizens aren't participating. And I don't like that because again, I'm American, I've got a loud mouth, and I'm very much about representative government. Like I like that. I want to know that I have a voice. I don't want to be told that I don't understand and that I should just be quiet and let the smart people in the room figure it out. That to me is an anathema to what I'm trying to achieve. Another rabbit hole.
No worries. So I'm satisfied with my question, so I will leave it over to Hemant.
Yeah. Thanks, Simon. Hi, Joshua.
Hello.
Hi. It's so nice to, you know, listen about your journey. It's been a very interesting podcast so far. You also told us, you know, why Finland, how it worked out for you, what kind of challenges you faced initially, and also so many different concepts, you know, and in a way, it's a good learning experience. But, you know, I feel that our listeners, through most of them would be in an urban setting, and they'll probably be a little motivated by your talk, and they would also like to do something similar, you know, like in the cities where we have vertical farming or, you know, greenhouse farming or terrace-based farmings or in their houses. So how do you think we could implement agroecological thinking in an urban setting, for example?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a very good question, because there are a lot of possibilities here. And in some ways, there's almost too many. You mentioned a lot of them, right? There, one thing that happens is once you elevate the biosphere to being where it should be, which is all around us, is that you don't draw the distinction between a farm and ecology, then there is no distinction between the urban space and ecology either. So ecology is happening all around us all the time. So getting that, you know, out of the head, and then focusing in on the core ecosystem processes. So understanding solar energy conversion to biological energy, and getting that conceptual framework to start to see the urban landscape as a place of resource flow and accumulation, right? So you can then begin to identify where good places might be, and also being very aware of the legacy of pollution and, you know, where, you know, the brown sites, I don't think there's probably a word for that in Finnish as well, like they're real, they need to be taken into consideration. You know, even 5 or 6 years ago, inputs that would have been approved for human consumption may no longer be approved for human consumption. Like these forever chemicals, right? This was it PF, what is it? Somebody knows. You know, they're in like Teflon, it's in everything. But was it the World Health Organization changed the recommended rates from something that was doable to almost zero? And now that it's at almost zero, you know, a lot of farms are in trouble because they've used inputs that include these things and they bioaccumulate. So understanding that there are a lot of possibilities, but there are also a lot of potential drawbacks. And the second thing is that most people in the city don't have a lot of space to work with generally. But if you understand how ecological function operates, you'll realize you don't need much space in order to grow a lot of food and to do it on a relatively sustainable basis. So not being afraid to study and get started and then to fail and, you know, maybe chuck it in the bio waste if you have to, you know, and if you want to work alone, you work alone, but also more importantly is to find a community. So the nice thing about farming and gardening is that you can probably find a community that you feel comfortable in if the region is large enough. So like the Helsinki area, you can find people who are approaching it from community first and the farming is part of what they do. You can also find it where the gardening is first and the community just sort of happens as it goes. So you can find your niche by exploring and, you know, not, you know, how would I say, don't, you know, don't walk away with a ring on your finger the first time you meet a group, you know, go out and explore a little bit, do some dating, so to speak, you know, see where you feel comfortable and start growing, because urban spaces, like there's so much opportunity and it is something where you can feel like you're having a positive impact. But if you're the kind of person who immediately goes home and opens up the carbon footprint calculator and starts to jam in all your numbers, urban farming probably is not going to move the needle that much for you. So what are you doing it for? What is your motivation? Is your motivation to have a positive impact on the environment? Well, more than likely, you're not going to have a positive impact on the environment as an individual living in an urban space. It's just at the end of the day, it's a human ecology. It's a human system. It's a human landscape, human oriented landscape. And so, you know, the motivation probably should be to learn something about food, to learn something about your neighbors, to have fun and learn to laugh a little bit about what's going on and try to have a good ride while we're here. Because, you know, really, like, I live in an apartment. I don't like this. Like, I would love to get out and be away. But it offers me a lifeline, you know, it gives me something where I have the biophilia that's part of being a human can express itself. And then you also get to start to challenge received wisdom from people that you, you know, a lot of people that you might respect, but also you might start to hear arguments from people that you didn't respect before you started. And you're like, wait a minute. And now I have this experience and it connects. And suddenly you start to see other people not as adversaries belonging to different groups, but as other people with valuable insights and life lessons that we could all learn from each other. Because the rural-urban divide is huge. And how can we make a link? You can forge a link by getting urban people to understand something about the challenges of rural people. And rural people can forge a link with urban people by providing things to them in the way that they would like them to be produced and doing it profitably. So there's cross-pollination that takes place from something as small as a urban garden. And it's not, last thing I'll say is, it's not just me blowing this out, you know, from orifices that no one should see in public. Like, there are so many initiatives all around the world where these kind of things are taking place and it's forming real communities. So, you know, this digital stuff is nice, but the real work happens outdoors.
Yes, Joshua, I completely agree. Like, these were some good insights, and I will be touching back upon the community factor you mentioned. But, you know, I was also reflecting on the fact of, you know, your definition of permaculture, and I'm coming from India. So, you know, back in India, like, if you go like really two centuries back, we had this shifting agriculture, you know, where rural people would just clear a piece of land, they would light fire to it. And like permaculture, they would allow the natural aspects of earth, like, you know, rainwater and sunlight to, you know, have processes going on. So yeah, it was interesting to reflect how, you know, even in the urban life, we can go ahead with this. But I was thinking as to, you know, if anyone just starts with this journey, what you mentioned, like, how much time do you reckon it could take to reach a full potential, like, for this entire journey and the process in an urban setting?
In an urban setting, as a new, you're talking from a garden, about for a garden to reach?
Yeah, right from the basics, yeah, like, yeah, just for a newbie, yeah.
So if you were to start, well, you know, I had zero farming experience while running a farm and very little beforehand, before I started. So I went from having a little bit of gardening knowledge, I've done some stuff, right? I had the theoretical background. In 2017 was my first growing season as a farmer. At 2019, by the end of 2019, three growing seasons later, I had already peaked the maximum production that I could get out of that space that I thought. So if you can give yourself 5 years, I think 5 years is a solid 4 to 5 years. And that would even be in a place like this where your learning is like this. it's not kind of up and down, but it starts and it stops because of the climate. So one of the things that I always say is that what I'm trying to share with people, this overarching view of agroecology, ecosystem processes, human beings are also part of this millions of years long evolution. Whatever started it, you know, if you have a spiritual belief or a religious belief that says something else started the journey of life, that's fine. I actually do. But I don't care where it started, but this link, human beings have the ability to read landscapes, understand what they see around them, and to share the information. Our ancestors were practicing horticulture of some kind for millions of years. What was the Stone Age? The Stone Age was human beings honing the skills of working within their ecosystems. So I don't think that unless someone is, you know, born with a, you know, severe physical disability, right? Or something, you know, there's something that is outside of the normal pattern of being a human. You know, almost everybody can learn this stuff if they actually want to. It's mindset. There's nothing about being a human that's like, because this is about reintegrating, reconnecting with our past. Give yourself 5 years and you'll be growing so much food, nobody wants to be your friend anymore because all you do is eat zucchini and kale.
Yeah, Joshua, like, I completely agree. Like, thank you for this timeline as to how you connected with the past and how the future would be like. But a quick final question, because you talked about community, so, you know, I'm provoked to ask that. I've also read about your theater forest garden project where, you know, you're integrating all the various aspects of the ecosystem. So as you mentioned, you know, your public community, they have given you wood chips, they've given you green compost. So, like, what would you expect more from the public community in Finland to help you contribute in your journey and how, you know, you can also grow it, like Finch agroecology can grow in the coming years. So what do you expect from the public?
Well, I don't actually, okay, if I expected anything from the public, it would be to come up with a much more clear agricultural policy that is based on measurable outcomes from farms. And then get out of the way. That's what I would expect. Get out of the way. Because I am so tired of these false ideas that punish farmers for doing novel things. So, for example, our project that we're doing, we have to remove a portion of it from the subsidy system. Why? Because I've planted trees that don't produce fruit. Now, we're also planting lots of trees that produce fruit, and the ones that don't produce fruit are there to support the ecosystem and to provide necessary inputs to the system. But nope, not allowed, got to take it away. So one of the things I would like to see is the public really start to think about what they want Finland to look like. What does Finland, you know, in 2100 look like if we could have the landscape that we wanted? Clean drinking water in all of the lake, you know, all the rivers, all the lakes. Great. Put that up at top. Biodiversity, put it to the top. Put these things up to the top. And then when farmers start to implement things that you don't understand, but they're moving in the direction you've set, without, of course, doing something weird behind their back that, you know, is not allowed, then that, you know, like using some kind of chemicals or something that, you know, is right there. We could always think of caveats. Then to really support that, because farming in Finland may never be this high profit, super economically viable thing. We live in a world, even with, if we're going to degrowth and move away from fossil fuels, food is going to be transported long distances. Finland is always going to have a very weird and wacky climate because we're at the top of the planet. Like, we just have to deal with that. So if we want farmers to move towards the goals that society sets, and society being well more than 90% of the people who live here, most people don't farm, then we also need to think about need to think about the social status of farmers and all the things that society asks them to do. Because it's not fair, from my perspective, to ask farmers to fix all of the world's problems, because when it comes down to it, the vast majority of the land is being managed by farmers. Even in Finland, if it's a forest, it's probably a farmer who owns, you know, maybe that owns a lot of this land, right? So you can't separate those two things. If those farmers don't have a way to feel appreciated socially, culturally, and economically, they're going to be alienated and they won't be able to participate in the society that is asking so much of them. So if I would ask anything about the Finnish public, it would be like, look, you don't want to be a farmer, fine. Don't, look, I'm not saying everybody should be a farmer. That's okay. But, you know, farmers, they're losing their farms. They're losing their heritage. Young people don't want to be farmers anymore. What do we want? You know, what do you want? And that's one of the biggest problems that I like kind of degrowth kind of gets into this, because it asks people, like, what kind of world do you want to live in? And we have to get serious, because I hate this climate crisis. If it's a crisis, we would be doing something. Obviously, enough people don't think it's a crisis who have the resources to do otherwise. So, you know, either it's a, you know, you got to decide. Either it's a crisis and we're going to come together as a society, as citizens, not as consumers, but as citizens who have something to share with each other. And we're going to try to chart a way forward so that our species and all the other species that are here that we are, you know, in community with can continue, then we need to have a real conversation and not, you know, how much meat did you buy at the market, and have that determine whether you're a good person or a bad person. We need to get serious, and we need to stop shying away from these rabbit holes, because they're only rabbit holes when the culture says that that's a place you're not supposed to go. You're questioning, you're asking too many questions. Someone else who's better than you has figured this out already. And that's
yes,
something
Joshua,
you got to step away from. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. Like, it was a holistic point, and I understand the frustration, because you're looking at, you know, having the tree for, say, ecological balance, for, you know, avoiding deforestation, for avoiding better soil retention capacity, or it's a carbon sink, whereas people want it for a fruit, like, you know, for a public utility. They are looking at the output, but you're looking at a much granular and a deeper level. So before I ask Camilla to take over, like, it was really insightful, and I understand your viewpoint, and I will be happy to share with the other listeners. But yeah, Camilla, if you can go ahead with the final segment of the podcast. Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you for your questions. They're all very good questions.
Yeah,
it's probably not what anyone expects from the podcast, but I always speak as honestly as I can to the people who are here.
Yeah, we appreciate it, your honesty. Yeah, thank you so much.
Yes, and I'm just going to try to wrap up this podcast with a few last questions, because we are, and probably our listeners will be students as well. And we don't necessarily have the most amount of money. I want to ask you, do you have any affordable tips for interested students on how individuals could support or get engaged in agroecology?
Well, you know, I also started from that same position, right? I mean, that was another part of my story that I left out. It wasn't just that we can engage with the world around us in different ways that support the system and kind of fight global warming or climate change. It was also that as a student, I didn't have very much money, and the food that I was being told is healthy was outside of my price range. But then, you know, you look around and you see all of this space getting irradiated by solar energy that's growing no food. And you realize, wait, you know, for a little bit of investment, learn something and invest in a small garden, you know, you can alleviate, or you can mitigate, you can help out a lot of these problems that people have. And so it's probably a bit challenging for students, especially in our climate, because the academic year corresponds kind of with the non-growing season, more or less. So you can't really form a group of people during the academic year to tackle these, you know, directly, like food-related things. But you can start, if the university has a campus, or if students or an alumni has land somewhere nearby, you could think about doing what I failed to do, which was create a student community garden, a student community association that tries to do these things. And in that way, you can get hands-on, you know, growing information. You can learn how soil works, you can learn how the water cycle works in this place, you can learn tough lessons. And you know, YouTube is free, although I think there's some paid stuff on YouTube now. I'm old enough to remember when it was, you know, all free and there were no ads, but you can learn an incredible amount for free. And that's one of the neatest things about regenerative agriculture and agroecology right now, is that we understand, and I'll use the royal we understand that no one individual, no one company is going to monopolize the space. because the things that farmers need to do are process-based and knowledge-based. So invest your time. That's one thing that usually students have a fair bit of, is time. Invest the time that you have into learning these things, and especially learning them from people that you would normally not listen to. So if you run across somebody who speaks with a weird accent, who's from, you know, the countryside, you know, somebody who's not from the bubble that you're in, instead of turning the podcast or the video off and, you know, say, ah, you know, it's I'm from an American perspective. Oh, this redneck can't even speak English. I'm from the South, so I can make these jokes. You know, you stop and you listen and you will learn a lot. So it doesn't take much. This community wants to share. They want people to be engaged. But if you're going to do it, the highest price to pay, in my opinion, is following through. You know, it'd be better if you don't say anything at all. Because we start to overshare. We start to invite and give advice. And then if it doesn't move forward, you know, it just sort of feels a little bit bad. Not that we expected anything in return, but like, you know, buck the trend of the lazy university student who doesn't follow through and follow through. That would be my advice.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think, okay, we can take one last question and then I think we're done. So I would like to know, where do you see yourself and Finch agroecology in 10 years?
Oh, I have no idea. Well, the whole world gets pulled upside down. So the business was based upon having a living working model. And before I even started it, I had presented a timeline of that eventually split out and said, is what I'm doing working or not working? And presented different options for what would happen afterwards. So I thought that instead of having my whole world, you know, turned upside down, that it would be a discussion about changing what happens there in the future. So I was really thrown into a pretty bad place, you know, a year and a half ago when I was told that I'd have to move out. So I would hope that in 10 years, if I'm still working as a farmer or in this space, that I have a farm that's at least 50 hectares of fields, and then it could have as much forest as attached to that as possible. But that's where I would like to be. I would like to be as close as possible to the economics of farming. And I like the project. I like being a project manager. But I also really loved being a farmer. And so I hope that I have lots of trees and lots of cows. And if I have anything other than trees and cows, then that's a bonus. So that would be that's where I hope that I could be in 10 years.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for your great and extensive answers. And thank you for your time. If you're interested to hear the podcast episode, we can fairly send it to you. It's mostly you talking, so if you want to hear it again, I don't know. Thank you. It was super interesting, and it was nice to hear about your story, and we appreciate your input.
Well, thank you very much. It was nice to have this opportunity to listen and to talk, I guess mostly two. It happens often in interviews, is that I talk too much, but I hope that if someone finds it interesting, at least, you know, it is a different perspective. So
yeah.
Good luck with everything, with your course, with your studies. And, you know, if you ever feel like reaching out, you know where to find me. You can share the podcast if you want, but I try to avoid looking at how many people have watched or commented, because yeah, I'm not very good at comparing myself to myself, and you know.
I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this podcast with us. It's been really, really good for us, and I think many of us students will find it interesting, and we are becoming small fanatics one of us, one by one. I think it's really, really interesting content this course, and this is a good sample event to that. Hearing from someone.
Yeah. Thank you from my side also.
All right, well, thank you. Yeah, it's a real pleasure.
All right, good. Then we wish you the good luck with the cows and the trees.
Yeah, we'll see. It's true. I honestly, I don't even know anymore. We'll see. Yeah. It's going to be what it is.
Yeah.
All right, take care.
All right, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.